From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a 26-minute video called Plandemic was released earlier this month. The video is filled with falsehoods, misinformation, and conspiracy theories. It quickly spread throughout the social media ecosystem, and it has been celebrated by the anti-vaccine movement. The film features a discredited former medical researcher named Judy Mikovits, who claims that the coronavirus pandemic was planned as part of a worldwide conspiracy to force billions of people to get vaccines. If you have been frustrated to see that family or friends have posted links to the video approving of its message, you might wonder how to address them. The Atlantic Monthly interviewed experts for a piece they titled, "If Someone Shares the Plandemic Video, How Should You Respond?" We thought we'd follow that thread. This hour, it's a conversation about plandemic, but it's also a broader conversation about how do we become susceptible to conspiracy theories and misinformation? How does information get through to us? How might we talk to one another? Interestingly enough, experts in science and communication have different approaches to dealing with videos like Plandemic. Most agree it's not helpful to shame or mock someone for sharing the video. But here's where they might diverge. Should you refute the claims in the video point by point? Experts like Dr. Mike Varshavsky say yes, and they've posted extensive videos countering each claim carefully and with evidence. Others like Rachel Pilch-Loeb, a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, advise against point-by-point takedowns. Pilch-Loeb says arguing the merits is almost always ineffective. So what can be done? Our guests are here to help us talk to one another better. Joining us for the hour, Zeynep Soysal is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester. Zeynep, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Great to have Richard Feldman, a professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester. I keep calling you Dean Feldman. Richard, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. It's good to be here.
And Jeremy Sarakin is the chair of the Media and Communications Department and associate professor and program director of interactive media, video, and game design at St. John Fisher College. Jeremy, welcome to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Thank you.
Jeremy, how long did it take for you to see somebody post this on one of your feeds?
So I actually didn't actually see it until basically you guys called me, and I had to sort of search for it and finally find it.
But you hadn't even heard of it?
I'd heard of it.
Oh, okay. No, that's more what I mean. I mean, like, how fast were people posting this? Because I saw it almost instantly, and it was a combination of people who immediately said, "This every word of this is true," versus people going, you know, this is just interesting. I'm just going to leave it here. I don't know. Make up your own mind. So that kind of a thing.
Well, I think what it is I think it's how people use social media. So I spend the social media time I do spend, I often actually spend on Facebook versus Twitter. And, you know, admittedly, I think my Facebook experience is a bit of a bubble. People who I happen to connect with on that platform probably would be less inclined to watch us in the first place. So that's kind of, and again, it sort of affects how I perceive news. And so for that reason, it didn't show up. I'd heard about it in, you know, more general news formats, but not actually on social media. I think had I been more active on Twitter, obviously it would have come up much more quickly.
Sure. I mean, I mostly use Twitter because I hate myself and I want to be depressed all the time. I'm mostly kidding. And I've gotten a lot of really, really helpful information from Twitter, from the epidemiological community in the last 2 months. If you really can sort of collate your feed, it's really helpful. But to Jeremy's point, it can be really toxic. So let me ask all three of you, and I'll start with Zeynep. Most experts I've seen, I don't really know any experts who say, yes, shaming and mocking is the way to go when someone shares a claim or a video or a conspiracy theory that is pretty clearly false. Go ahead and shame or mock them. Zeynep, is there any value in that?
I don't think there's any value in shaming people. I mean, in general, I think, you know, it's important to realize that you know, a lot of these people who are posting these things, they're not evil. They're not indifferent to truth, or at least they don't see themselves as being indifferent to truth. So, you know, treat them as though they are evil, or as though they're silly, or as though they should be shamed is absolutely a counterproductive way of approaching such conversations, even though it can be really tempting to do something like that. So, I also read this article that you mentioned in The Atlantic, "If Someone Shares the Plandemic, How Should You Respond?" And it seems like, again, there's just this general phenomenon, the psychological phenomenon that everyone agrees with, which is if you shame people or if you make them feel bad, they are more likely to get on the defensive and reject what you're telling them. This is just a very natural mechanism. If we're hurt, we attack. If we feel bad, we are not going to be open to hearing criticisms or to hearing. So I think in that sense, shaming, you know, maybe sometimes it's okay to hurt people for the greater good, but in this case, it's absolutely not, I think, one of these cases. It's completely counterproductive.
Okay. Richard Feldman, are there moments where shaming or mocking is a useful tool?
I suspect it's rare that's true. I think the way to deal with things like that will really depend on the circumstances and perhaps who it is that you're engaged with. You know, there can be somebody who shares something, but a person who's pretty open-minded and wanting to learn the truth. And with a person like that, shaming is clearly inappropriate, but also sharing information could be useful. They might be open to learning something. There's other people who are utterly convinced of their views, and there's little that you can do. It's not a matter of more information is going to really help. Reading some of this stuff online, there was a very nice essay at The Atlantic with a woman who had been involved in some conspiracy theories as a teenager, and she said, you know, no information was going to talk her out of it, but eventually she got bored with it.
I don't mean to be laughing. I'm sorry. It was just interesting. It was interesting.
So I think it's really going to be different. There's going to be people who I think it's just very hard to engage, and it might be best to say, you know, I disagree and leave it at that.
But Rich, it sounds like what you're advising is we've got to try to read a person we may be communicating with and ascertain, are they truly at the point where it's sort of not worth a point-by-point refutation versus are they actually looking for information?
Absolutely right. I think that's true here. I think that's true in general. You need to know your audience and who are you interacting with, because what's useful or helpful in one case may not be so in another.
Jeremy, what do you make of mocking?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree that certainly the idea of mocking someone isn't going to get you very far. I think it depends really on who you're engaging and where. So if it's someone you know, whether it's on social media or, you know, someday in person, you can sort of engage and sort of have sort of a personal conversation, hopefully not get angry at each other because you know each other, and speak about, and I always find it's helpful to sort of use, you know, professorial skills and say, so why do you believe it? Like, let them answer first. And sort of see what it is about this video or any kind of meme that was convincing. If it's someone you don't know, I mean, a lot of people, myself included, have occasionally engaged with someone on some feed somewhere, then it's a different tack. I mean, you're not going to mock, obviously. But there, you know, the approach might just be like almost the same thing, perhaps. What is it that's convincing you? Or simply, here's a couple things I've noticed that don't seem to be true and see where it takes you. The couple of experiences I've had, often they just sort of get angry and then it's sort of the end of it. But it's all we can sort of do is try to sort of point out truth without making it personal.
Yeah. And so let me just kind of build on one of the points Jeremy's making about refuting individual points. I have in this paper right here just a stack of individual claims made in Plandemic and the factual information that indicates why they are false. I mean, I don't really want to do this a whole hour because I want to talk more generally about how we communicate better with one another. But listeners, I know you may have legitimate questions. And what I want to say as, you know, I know this may sound cheesy, but as lovingly as I can, is that we're in a dangerous moment here. You know, this is an important moment that we not be sharing misinformation because, you know, unfortunately, people are dying by the hundreds or thousands every day in this country still. And so we've got to at least have some common truth. We can disagree about ideas about where we go next, but we got to be very careful. And that's why when Plandemic hit, I just sort of advised the community that I communicate with, you may see this. It is largely a grift in search of marks, but I don't mean to belittle because, you know, it's slickly made, it's well produced. And it may be appealing to some people. And if you do want to talk facts, we can do that. We're not here to mock or belittle. I think all of our guests are making that point, and they are the experts, and I happen to agree with them. But if you have individual questions, I guess we can do that, but I'm also curious to know how you're communicating with people. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. And Zainab, let me ask you to respond to a listener named Matthew, who writes to me on Twitter, and he opened the hour by saying, "Evan, I can't wait to hear the party line." He's mocking me because I'm defending the quote party line that says plandemic is not true. He followed up to say that there has to be some truth in this video, seeing as how fast it was taken down from YouTube. Can you address that? Because Facebook has tried to scrub it. YouTube has tried to scrub it. Can you address that, Zainab?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated issue. It's true that, you know, taking videos down might convey a different message, namely that, it's very hard to say what exactly is the right thing to do about the pandemic video right now. Maybe it will fuel more conspiracy theories if it's all wiped down from the internet right now. That's a hard, maybe almost empirical question. But maybe something about the party line business. I think that's, I mean, there's a general problem that I think in, you know, many general problems in the way we are used to thinking. And one of them is that we believe things wholesale or not at all. So there's a very much a lack of nuance in the way we make decisions and in the way we form beliefs in general. And so that I think is a very deep problem that is at the heart of also, you know, people who believe in conspiracy theories like this. And that's something that should be addressed. So I think we should all acknowledge that, first of all, there aren't just two, and this is something that Richard Feldman says, in the textbook for Reason and Argument. This is something, I think, a very valuable observation, which is, there aren't just two options available for us, believe or disbelieve. There are all sorts of ranges of attitudes that we can have towards one claim, namely, for instance, you can be confident about it, you can be a little bit confident about it, you mm-hmm. can be completely unsure about it, so you can suspend your judgment. And certainly that's true for packages of beliefs. So, for instance, in this pandemic video, again, I didn't watch it either. I couldn't find it on the internet, but I watched, takedowns of it and list of all the facts that are or all the claims that are being made. It's of course maybe some of them have some points to them. It's not it's very rarely an all or nothing thing, and I think. Belief and forming beliefs shouldn't be thought of on this, rooting for a football team kind of manner, you know, the party line versus the other line. It's not, we should be much more nuanced. I mean, I have many more things to say about this, but that's, I guess, how I would say to react in general to people who, reject what you're saying by saying, oh, you're rejecting everything, you're towing the party line, is to be yourself a bit more nuanced in the claims you are making, perhaps, and to grant certain things to people, that some things are complicated. It's not at all clear. For instance, you know, she's saying certain things about the way that hospitals, you know, receive money.
Yeah, reimbursements.
For
that's
COVID.
Right.
For reimbursements, and that is true. They do receive it, and you might say, okay, so are there certain wrong incentives given to hospitals because, let's say, they receive a flat rate, and this is not just for COVID-19. This is for, you know, any kind of disease, for instance, they receive a flat rate to treat it, and you might ask questions about, okay, is that the best way to structure payments in hospitals for treatment? Is it going to, for instance, incentivize doctors to do perhaps a little bit less to save a little bit of money on, you know, so there are really complicated issues here, and it's important to be just more nuanced in general.
Yeah, and it sounds to me, Zainab, like if you show a little grace, if you acknowledge mm-hmm. where there might be some validity to certain claims, yeah. does that maybe open a door potentially?
It does, because then you're taken to validate all of them. And again, that comes from this way that we have of thinking, which is, oh, you know, for instance, if you hold one, let's say, Republican-leaning belief, then that's it. You're a Republican or Democrat. It's the same thing. So we have this very simplistic way of conceiving of beliefs, and I think that's really fundamentally the problem. And we should talk more about this. We should just be always much more explicit about how difficult it is to find out the truth and how uncertain we are, and how it's not only just okay to be uncertain, but it's the right thing to be uncertain about certain things. And to just emphasize, it's not a wholesale rejection, it's not a wholesale buying. I mean, I can't really think of other ways of doing it except to be really explicit, to repeat these basic things over and over again when you engage in conversation.
That
might be one way.
This is so valuable, because what Zeynep is saying here, I'm just going to try to bookmark in my brain. There are certain things that we know are false in the video, and there are certain things that are speculation in the video, and there are certain things that are, you know, sort of uncertain. And acknowledging some uncertainty or some openness for everybody is important. Nuance is important. In fact, the best communicators during a crisis tend to be, and they're usually, you know, government leaders, sometimes public health, they will say to the public, we don't have all the answers. We are going to do our best with the information we have, and we're going to let you know when the information changes. Because for those who say we have all the answers, and then a month later things change, the public goes, well, what are we doing here? Because you didn't communicate the humility. And so, that's a good lesson that's such a good lesson.
Evan, this conversation, I think, really illustrates two of the things that are especially noteworthy about conspiracy thinking of the sort we're talking about. And one is because, you know, the idea behind in the conspiracy is that there's this widespread collaboration, and all the people in power typically are in alignment on it. So your taking down the video just feeds that. I mean, it's just more part of the story. It's more evidence. It's not seen as evidence against. It's seen as more evidence for. And the other thing is, you know, I completely agree with Zeynep about the importance of acknowledging uncertainty and not having opinions where you don't have a basis for them and being honest about all of that. But one of the things that can be so appealing about conspiracy theories is that, at least in some cases, what they do is provide this unified, large-scale explanation of all kinds of things. And that's very satisfying to us. We want explanations. We sort of seek them. And so when somebody provides one for you, that's appealing, in contrast to somebody who says, well, we really don't know.
I think that's fair. And to Matthew on Twitter, let me just say, you know, my own view on YouTube taking the video down. I'm curious to know what Jeremy, who's a professor of media, will say. So I guess what I would say to Matthew on that is this. If I were the inventor and the owner of YouTube, if my name were John T. YouTube and it was my thing and, you know, billions of posts a day and videos everywhere, I would be very hesitant to take down anything. There are certain standards and there are lines you draw, but mostly my default would be don't take it down. Don't take it down. I can understand the argument for doing it with Plandemic. I'm not sure I agree that it was the right thing to scrub it, but I understand the argument, because let's say you had, you know, millions of people who believed a video in which the person said, human beings actually have the ability to fly, but you can't gain the ability without jumping off a building, because in flight is when you gain that ability. Just go do it. And millions of people believed this and they could die. I could understand the idea of saying, look, you got to get that video down. We cannot risk people here. That is more extreme or more sort of stark than what we're talking about with Plandemic, but lives are at stake. And do I understand the urge to say we're not going to let destructive information, not just wrong information, but harmful information travel? I do understand it. I'm not sure it's right here, but I understand the urge. I'm trying to show a little grace there. I mean, Jeremy, what do you say to people like Matthew who say, hey, YouTube took it down, there must be something to it?
Right. No, I think this actually corresponds to sort of like the classic sort of First Amendment teaching point, which is you can't go into a crowded theater and yell fire because it's putting people at risk. You know, you're not free to do that. I actually think that one could make the argument that this falls under that category, that it is really, I think the math part is sort of, which is sort of like, honestly, sort of like sort of one of the more absurd parts of the video, is really the part that puts people at immediate risk. You know, basically making this claim that you don't need to do it. The science, for anyone who's taken any kind of science at all, like in high school, you're like, that, I mean, I sat there going, I don't know if that makes any sense at all, actually. And I think that, to me, is sort of a justifiable reason to do it. What's happened as a result of that, and we've been talking about this, is that it sort of feeds into the conspiracy theory. Because if it's being taken down, you're like, just as the person who wrote in has said, you know, there must be something to that. You know, they don't necessarily want to sort of see the nuances, perhaps, of, you know, First Amendment rights, as opposed to there must be something more going on.
Yeah, I think that's people mistake that all the time. I mean, you can say something, you have the right to say it, but you don't have the right to have a business or a company decide that you can say it in perpetuity if they decide it violates their standards or what they're doing. I mean, that's
right.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
I think the other interesting thing about social media is that there's so much on there, like think of YouTube, that's ridiculous. Like, it's just, I mean, it's badly made. It's, like, a lot of it's nonsense. A lot of it's, you know, a lot of things. It's not nonsense, just people doing silly things, like, in their house, whether it's on TikTok or YouTube. And we've come to accept all of this as a form of valid entertainment and, in some cases, valid news. And they're not being taken down. I mean, you could say that, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is because they're not dangerous immediately. The second thing is that perhaps no one notices it. I mean, if there's some random video that someone makes that's filled with theories, but it has 26 views, not that it shouldn't be taken down, but no one comes to do that, and no one really cares because it hasn't really had a huge effect on anything. So I think, in a way, the fact that it went viral is what made it people take notice. And so as a result of that, but it sort of like feeds into, oh, well, it was super important in the sense that many people watched it. Those things don't correlate, but people might think that. And so, as a result, you know, there's something more to this than it's just being something that's unsafe.
So, listeners, as we talk about not just plandemic, but how we communicate with one another, especially when we see misinformation that gains velocity, I've got a full board of phone calls. If you're on the phone, our second half hour is all your calls. The last thing I will ask our guests is this. Just tell me how you respond if on your social media pages or if in your sphere of life, a friend or a family member says the following. They reach out and they say, or they write a post and it says, and I will now use some of the claims that this video makes that are all not correct. But if they say, hey, here's this video, and it shows that that this virus definitely came from a lab, that there's this researcher who was treated unfairly, and she's got really important information that shows Anthony Fauci and others are part of a plan to get this virus going around the world so we can force billions of people to get a vaccine that might not be safe, and also wearing a mask might make you sick, and the government is denying use of hydroxychloroquine against the virus, even though they know it will work. None of that's true. But if they say, look, this video shows all this stuff and you got to watch it, you got to check it out, it's really important. Zeynep, what's a constructive way to respond? I want to hear the Zeynep Soysal response to that.
Oh, it's really hard. I mean, I think it's what Rich said and what Jeremy said are correct. It depends on the person. It depends on how well you know them, what you know about them. So, for instance, if this was a family member, let's say, and they just post it just as a, you know, oh, here, check this out, with that kind of, they're not saying it's completely true because that might be a little bit of a, more desperate case. But if they just posted, I probably would write to them and say, look, there is a private message, first of all. Again, I think there's a lot of, public posturing going on in Facebook that makes it very difficult to have rational conversations because it's all public. And it becomes a bit of a competition and a popularity, competition and also a way of, flagging adherence to certain whatever groups. So public discussion on Facebook is very difficult to do rationally. But a private message perhaps saying, look, it's harmful to spread, to give more voice and more momentum to a video like this that has been and then probably send them one of these fact check videos that I've watched one of them. There are many very good ones. For instance, there's one by Dr. Mike that goes through these points very, very well and sends them that and just explain to them briefly why it's actually harmful to give more clicks, give more voice to a video like this. Again, but this is if it's someone I know who I could have this conversation with in a private message or something.
All right. Rich Feldman, what is the Feldman response when this shows up in your inbox or on your wall?
So I should probably begin by saying I'm not much of a social media person.
Well, you got to role play for me, Rich.
So I've got email and I've got text and the like, but not so much of that. But still, in interacting with people, in talking, whether it's in person or over email or however, again, it's going to depend on the person. But I think what I would try to do is break things down into smaller points and try not to get into the whole thing as a hoax and instead look at some specific point and then at least try, if I think it's worth engaging, try to get the person to see that there is another point of view on that specific one and see if we can get somewhere on that and at least sort of shake them from their firm confidence. One of the things about sort of what generally we're thinking about when we talk about conspiracy theory, people are overly confident in their beliefs. They feel sure that this thing is true. And if you can at least knock them down a peg, make them see that on specific points there's questions, maybe you've got a wedge in there to get started.
All right, Jeremy, what's your response when you see it?
Sure. Well, I'm rather inclined, as time goes on, I think it depends on the person if you were going to direct message, but if someone's posting something publicly, I'm starting to feel more and more the sort of responsibility to, in a very sort of polite, appropriate way, perhaps denounce maybe is a strong word, but kind of show perhaps where something isn't correct publicly so the people who have seen it in the first place see the rebuttal. I find rather than giving sort of my own opinion, because I'm just another person doing that, or at least it will be perceived that way, if I can find reliable sources. One useful technique I've used, actually, is you can find something that gives an article in a mainstream newspaper that perhaps even leans, in this case, for example, sort of a right-leaning publication that's respected, that sort of gives a rebuttal. That actually can be the most effective thing to post, just as a please read this. You know, read this over before you continue to post this. Sort of
knowing thing. That certain sources may be rejected. Okay. Rich, do you want to jump back in?
I just wanted to quickly highlight something that Jeremy just said, which I think is important. And in the social media context, there's the person who posted something, but the audience is broader than that. So the question of who's your audience is complicated because there might be a wide variety of people. And so you might have a response that's not particularly effective for the person who posted this thing, but it could well make a difference to other people who are reading it. So there's just not a simple answer there.
That's a great point. All right. Your phone calls are going to come after our only break of the hour as we talk about ways that we can constructively, lovingly talk to one another, even when we find friends and family sharing misinformation or potentially harmful information. In this case, the release of a 26-minute video called Plandemic, filled with misinformation that could be harmful. And our guests are just giving us a good roadmap to talk to each other in more effective ways. Zeynep Soysol is a professor of philosophy at the University of Rochester, as is Richard Feldman. Jeremy Sarakin is chair of the Media and Communication Department at St. John Fisher College. Let's get your phone calls after our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we talk to people from PBS's Nova about their work focusing on treatment and vaccine for COVID-19. How is the work toward vaccine and treatment going? What's the latest? What has the team from Nova uncovered? You will hear from them Monday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get to your phone calls. Ken in Webster first. Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Thanks so much, Evan. Can you hear me fine?
I can. Yeah, go ahead.
So this is a fascinating conversation. And first of all, I want to make sure that I myself exercise respect and discourse, humility, right? Because I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a pandemic expert or anything like that. What I love about the conversation is first kind of that premise of what it means to have discourse, to converse with someone that perhaps has a completely opposing view, at least at the start of a conversation. And this notion of openness and needing to have an explanation. Some people are driven by it, and some people are not necessarily driven to learn more, change their ways. Without really revealing what side of, say, the vaccine, anti-vax or pro-vax, I'm at, which I thought was an interesting question from the person who filtered the phone call, right? Kind of like, oh, already they want to put me on one side or the other. Because perhaps it makes for good radio and good debate. But I wanted to acknowledge a few things from your guests, and I'll even toss my merhaba, günaydın to saying it, because I think it might be Turkish.
thank you.
So one of the things that is said is sort of being neighborly, and you know, we have a circle of influence that for some, having social media means I can reach everybody. I can set stage. I can be at the center of the attention. And then we have closer circle of influences, our family, our neighbors, close relatives. And I've been wanting to use these techniques that your guests are speaking about in the context of, say, political discourse, which is always kind of a tricky thing, right? But what I find most interesting is that I would say, just like your guests, I'm an open-minded person. I've had the set of values. I sort of communicate them when I speak to others. But the humility part is the one that resonates the most, which is to say, I don't know everything. And what I know might be wrong, might not be completely factual or absolute truth, capital T. So your guests, I presume, share the same values that I do. And yet we have these subtle ways of declaring our position, our bias. Richard, I think, said, you know, well, have a conversation. It depends on who you're talking to, and then shake them from their core, you know. Knock them down with questions. Your other guest said, well, anybody who's taken science in high school, right? And so I feel like it's really hard for us to say somebody who's in the other opposing view might have the exact same position, be like, well, I'm open-minded, and why aren't those other people listening? And, of course, I'm going to try to knock them down with confidence and speak about specific points. I think discourse has to have that. But what I would ask all of us, including your expert guests, is to perhaps question themselves as to what do we hold so true that that science, for example, that has been proven over time to kind of yield a fact but evolves over time. So what we think at one historical point is the truth, the thing.
Yeah.
Vaccines are this, or that eventually turns out to be augmented.
I'm going to let them respond, but let me hit a certain point here. The reason that the call screener asked you about that is because when you called, you told her you wanted to talk about the truth. And we thought it would be valuable to at least get a little bit more background on why you're calling and what that's about. That doesn't mean I don't want to take your call. You're the first call I took. I am not filtering calls based on stacking opinions one way or another. That is not the goal whatsoever. Now,
In fact, the term I used was truthiness, which I, you know, look on what we
oh, I know, I get you. Okay, sure.
To the truth, right?
I get
it
you.
It wasn't truth. I don't hold the truth.
Okay,
I
do think it's somewhat evasive of you not to answer whether you think vaccines have been effective because, you know, we can.
I actually did. I did to her, and I was just trying to prevent the.
I'm with you.
We can have discussions about it. Yeah? I'm anti and pro. How's that? Because I think
that's a dodge.
Purpose.
I think it's a dodge, Ken. And I think it's okay to want nuance, as Zainab says, and I want it too. But we can appeal to humility so much that we can sort of say, well, who's really an expert? We have to all be humble. Even the experts aren't experts. And I have just as much value in asserting information about the vaccine as anybody else, which is unfortunately not the case. I don't want to be in a world where my opinion counts as much on science as an actual scientist. I don't want to be in a world where I should be flying the plane instead of the pilot who's taken all of those courses and has all those years of experience. So that's the I think there is a
if only our leaders, some of our leaders would have that you know, that sense of humility.
All right, so let me clear the stage.
Let me, if you want, I can explain just the issue about whether you can be on one side or the other and being evasive. All I'm trying to say here is I am continuing to educate myself about what I learned as a kid and why it is that I participated in a vaccination program.
Okay.
And so Plandemic is one of the videos I watched, and there are absolutely things that I think are, you know, a bit on the one side or the other. There is another circulation happening that is of similar ilk, The Truth About Vaccines. So I wonder if any of your guests have watched it. Some of them said, I haven't even watched Pandemic, but I have an opinion about it. So what I would say is I happen to believe that vaccines and the process of its discovery has helped humanity. And at the same time, I'm learning about some of the compounds and some of the things that are put into vaccines that may have adverse effects. So, you know, when you listen to the things on the TV and they're like, you know, it'll help you with this, but counterindications, that's part of the truth, right? Getting information and then making an informed decision about the risks and respecting the person, mm-hmm. whether they choose to or not. Again, there's a social responsibility that we have, and some who would be very pro-vax would be like, no, you know, these people are causing us harm. And others in anti-vax would be like, no, you're really, you know, you're making your son autistic. I mean, it could be the gamut. But perhaps what we should really be doing is demanding, say, from those in authority, those in power, those who we pay to be servants of the people, to really do depth research on any topic, on other things, so that we can be more informed.
All right, Ken.
And that's true for a lot of things, right?
I'm glad you called. Thank you, Ken. Let me turn it over to Zainab first. Go ahead, Zainab.
So there are many things, many super interesting points that have been raised. I mean, one thing that you mentioned, Evan, in responding, is a very important point, which is you know, humbleness and yet accepting that some people are better at getting at the truth than others, so in particular experts. And I think that's a really important point to bring across. So, I mean, when I mention humbleness and confidence, I think that for some respects, and in particular for, let's say, the current crisis that we're seeing right now, the pandemic crisis, it's such a complicated problem with so many variables, so many different moving pieces, that I don't think anybody should be confident about exactly what's the best thing to do. Okay, so I think even the top experts are, you know, should have some, you know, high level of confidence in certain things, but they can't be sure. It's just too complicated.
Right.
That being said, of course, we should go with what they say as opposed to what some, you know, random non-expert says about, let's say, you know, how to best coordinate efforts of whatever, staying the lockdown or vaccine for that matter. And, you know, some people are just better at figuring out certain things than others. I mean, this is, you know, and doctors, you know, scientists have been, you know, just, you know, in general, their methods lead to truths more often. And so we should, of course, defer to them. So I think it's absolutely compatible to both hold this humbleness and thinking that even the experts have to be humble because things are very difficult. And in fact, just something about science, you know, science is all about uncertainty. So science talks about probabilities, about statistical significance, about error bars. So these probabilistic notions are part and parcel of the way that science is done. It's never like yes or no. Science has left the common yes or no attitudes behind and embraced uncertainty, and that's the way that they are able to be so successful. And but of course, you know, they're just much better at getting these probabilities than, let's say, someone who has no background knowledge about this, like myself, for instance. Don't ask me what to do about this pandemic. Ask the experts, absolutely. So that's one point that I wanted to emphasize. I think it's a really important point that came out of what you said and what the phone conversation was about.
And let me turn to Rich. I'm so glad Zainab brings that up because, you know, this notion of humility and how you have these conversations with people. You know, Rich, I had some weak moments earlier this week on Twitter in which a gentleman in Rochester was saying that he was going to be proud to be the only one man in Wegmans not wearing a mask, and no one could make him do it, and you can't force him to give up his liberty, and this whole thing is ridiculous. And, you know, I said, look, I promise you I'm trying to listen, but this one's not about you. This is about us showing a responsibility to help protect others. And he says who? And he says Anthony Fauci in the end of January said masks probably don't help. Now he says masks help. Well, I'm going to listen to Fauci. I said, well, if you're listening to Fauci, he has admitted that his position has evolved with the evidence. He said, no, you're just picking and choosing now. I said, no, I'm not picking and choosing. Even the experts, as Zainab says, either get it wrong or have to learn or take into account new information. That doesn't mean that if 6 weeks ago they said something and they come to you and say, look, this new information tells us to change course, that doesn't mean all experts at all moments in time should just be invalidated. And I don't know how to talk to people who think that proved, just because Anthony Fauci said 10 weeks ago that he's not sure masks will help, and now he says we all need to be wearing masks, does that invalidate Anthony Fauci? I think it's the opposite. I think it shows he's open to information.
It shows that he can learn things, which is what we'd hope. It shows that he's open to new evidence and he can learn from them. So I just had two quick thoughts about the recent conversation.
Sure.
One is about expertise. I think we should pay attention to the experts, and we should acknowledge when there's topics that we don't know much about and there's others that have a greater deal of information. But we also have to be careful about domains of expertise. So somebody who's an expert on, say, how vaccines work might not therefore know about what's the best thing to do in terms of balancing public health needs and economic considerations in the current situation. So they're not necessarily experts on economic matters. And I think Fauci, in some cases, I've heard him speak, and he's very clear about that. Being conscious of it, of what the topic of expertise really is. The second thing I want to say goes back to the caller, who I thought made some really interesting comments, and I can make this very quick. It's about being conscious of the point of discussion with somebody. Why are we interacting with them? And there's many different reasons, but sometimes somebody says something and you disagree, and the point, your goal then is to convince them of your side. But there's a very different kind of attitude you can have toward interacting with somebody, and it's what can I learn from this? And can we collectively try to get at the truth? And the second attitude is one that in a great many cases is the far more valuable one, the more rewarding one, and the one that I've tried to encourage and try to live by. And here's the really complicated thing in this case, and I think this is your comment about the person who didn't want to wear a mask in Wegmans. When what's at issue is something that is potentially dangerous, that really changes the calculation.
Hmm. Jeremy, you want to weigh in briefly, and we'll grab some more phone calls. Go ahead.
Sure, of course. I thought the caller's first comment was really very interesting, and I actually sort of stuck with that a little bit. The idea, he said, and maybe I'm misreading it, but he said something like, you have a position of bias. And I remember thinking, one after the other, and I remember thinking, that's not the same thing, that it's okay to have a position in something, and it sort of depends on where you get it from. So, and we've been talking about this the last few minutes, but so I think a lot of it has to do with sort of critical thinking and media literacy and understanding what are your sources. Again, discipline specific, can this person that I'm reading about actually make something, can he make a claim that has any authority based on his own knowledge? So that's important. But also just understanding that certain sources have more of a scientific foundation or more of sort of historical foundation or have been written from one perspective or another and really trying to sort of think it through. And I that's sort of a very general comment. But I think, if you sort of, and this is something anyone can do, but if you sort of develop sort of the ability to sort of critically analyze all these sources, I think you come to having a position, which I think is okay and isn't really the same as having a bias.
Yeah, I think when people send emails or, sort of attack people in the media, you have a bias. Yes, I have a bias. I'm a human being. I am not the only objective person who sees the world for exactly as it is. I would love if that were true. But this idea of unbiased journalism is not a thing. That does not exist. So I think the most important thing to be is self-aware of your own biases, asking yourself, where does information that you get come from? Have you vetted the sources? Do you feel comfortable with it? And can you articulate what your biases may be? I can, and I'm certainly comfortable saying that I am not the only unbiased person, and I could perfectly be the arbiter of information and distill it. That will not be me. That does not exist. Bob in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, hi. This is maybe just another angle on what you're kind of saying in a different way. As both a journalist and a librarian, kind of over the years, I've talked about when sort of giving advice and following it myself, it's like, well, have your trusted sources and know where to turn to as your yardstick. So just for me as a case, I like The Economist, I like PBS, and a handful of others that I kind of go as my go-to. But I've come to realize that what I need to actually be doing is be actually more critical when I go to my trusted sources, because there's a tendency to just let it wash over you as facts. And I see that within myself, and I take in the information as, okay, this is my trusted source, and there are reasons it's my trusted source, but I'm less careful to maybe see potential problems or kind of push them away. So I think these days we want to, have your expert sources, but actually in some ways look at them more critically than others. And I think that might be a way out of this as well.
Bob, thanks for the phone call. Jeremy, what do you think?
You know, I think that's absolutely true. I think, in a way, the more you read and the more you expose yourself to, and again, I would say sort of amongst, reasonably accepted sources, I think the better. As one example, I find myself, if I'm watching too much, quote-unquote, sort of American media, I find it useful to watch BBC News. And again, that's almost not sort of the right-left sort of spectrum, but just seeing like, oh, right, this is how things in America are being perceived from outside. And I think, it's very easy to not do that sort of thing. And I also think that we get sort of a very sort of localized or at least national perspective on things. And I think looking at things globally is useful. But in general, yes, the more sources you can sort of take and then sort of make your own judgments, I think the better.
Rich Feldman, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it was Bob was the caller. I think that was a great point. And there's psychological literature pertinent to this. There's research showing that people have a tendency to kind of beat up on things that differ from the point of view that they come into it with and just casually accept things that come to the conclusion they like. And there's some studies that are really interesting where you have people who start with different points of view and they read the same things and they both come out more convinced of what they thought at the outset because of how they are so critical of what they differ with and so accepting of what they come in thinking about. And so I think the way around that is to do, I think, just what he suggested, and that is go to the things that you're inclined to accept, but try to look at them with as skeptical an eye as you can. And don't just sort of just take it. See if you can find any flaws or any things worth questioning.
I think that's a great point. To Bob's point, I mean, for those who watch Rachel Maddow, I mean, very smart woman, but her Twitter feed is filled with the fact that Texas reopened and now there's 1,000 new cases a day, more than there were a month ago. But I don't know if you're testing more. I don't have any context to the data.
Right.
I have
right.
no idea what right. that means. I don't know if that means that more people are infected or not. Don't just take it at face value. Interrogate it a little bit,
yeah.
even if it may conform with something you want to believe. And Zainab, Tom writes the following. It says, a good approach to conversations of this nature is to approach with genuine curiosity, especially with open-ended questions. Maybe you could tell me why you believe this. Help me understand what convinced you to accept this as truth. What about this video is it that you find so compelling? Wanting to understand another person is an effective way to converse without conflict. What do you think, Zainab?
Absolutely. I mean, just to repeat something that all of you have said, we all suffer from these cognitive biases. It's not just one part of the population that, has this tendency to think in certain ways. We all have them. In fact, the one thing that Rich mentioned at the beginning was this tendency to look for simple explanations or to read intention into things. And this is something that is very much at the core of why conspiracy theories are so popular and so satisfying. And this is something that it's not just the conspiracy theorists that have. We all have this. And there are, evolutionary reasons why we have certain why we read intention into things. You know, it was very important for us to recognize intentional actions for our fellow humans and prey and predators. So there are just certain mechanisms that we all have, and it's really important to notice that in this sense we're all on the same boat. We're all trying to do our best to get information that we all need to act successfully in the world. So I think to put that kind of background in a conversation to really feel like it's not, the purpose isn't to score a point or to definitely convince you of something, even though I completely agree with Rich, sometimes stakes are so high that you know that might be the purpose of a part of your conversation. But in general, it would be just so good if people could approach conversations as just a way of learning more, a way of gathering more evidence, and a way of making it the case that we all have more true beliefs at the end of the day, and not just a voicing of certain opinions that you hold for whatever reason. And this is something that I've said before. I keep repeating myself, but it's very. We all have we hold opinions so strongly, and it's not entirely clear that we should have as many opinions as we do. We should be more open to learning.
Yeah. And frankly, after a conversation, even if you're not happy with what you're hearing, can you accurately articulate what the person who disagrees with you feels and why?
Yeah.
Challenge yourself to do that. I'm really, really glad you were here for us this hour. All three of our guests, Zeynep Soysol and Richard Feldman, professors of philosophy at the University of Rochester, Jeremy Sarakin, chair of the Media and Communication Department at St. John Fisher College. Thank you so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Evan.
And to all the listeners, I hope you have a beautiful weekend. Enjoy it when you can. Rob Braden's the engineer, Megan Max the producer. Be loving, be kind, and we'll talk on Monday.